Matthew Ho, the Iraq war vet and foreign service officer who recently resigned his post in Afghanistan. American families, Ho said at the end of his letter of resignation, I'm going to quote, must be reassured that their dead have sacrificed for a purpose worthy of futures lost, love vanished, and promised dreams unkept. I have lost confidence that such assurances can be made anymore. So he's a former Marine captain with combat experience in Iraq. And he served in uniform at the Pentagon and as a civilian in Iraq and at the State Department. And this summer, he was the senior U.S. civilian in Zabul province, a Taliban hotbed. In September, Ho became the first U.S. official known to resign in protest over the Afghan war. His four-page letter of resignation explains that he became convinced that our war in that country will not only inevitably fail, but that it is fueling the very insurgency that we're trying to defeat. He points out that, quote, next fall, the United States occupation will equal in length the Soviet Union's own physical involvement in Afghanistan. I have doubts and reservations about our current strategy and planned future strategy, but my resignation is based not upon how we are pursuing this war, but why and to what end. In his Salon blog, Glenn Greenwald, writing about Ho's resignation, asks, I'm going to quote Greenwald now, how long are we going to continue to do this? We invade and occupy a country, and then we label as insurgents or even terrorists the people in that country who fight against our invasion and occupation. We then insist that we must remain in order to defeat the insurgents and terrorists, who are largely composed of people whose only cause for fighting is our presence in their country. All the while, we clearly exacerbate the very problem we're allegedly attempting to address, terrorism, by predictably and inevitably increasing anti-American anger and hatred through our occupation, which, no matter the strategy, inevitably entails our killing innocent civilians. The Pentagon's own 2004 report concluded, quote, this is quoting the Pentagon, negative attitudes and the conditions that create them are the underlying sources of threats to America's national security. Direct American intervention in the Muslim world has paradoxically elevated the stature of and the support for Islamic radicals. Welcome, Matthew Ho.
Thank you, Terrence.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Can you tell us a little bit about your path prior to this difficult decision you made in September? You know, things like, did you always want to be a soldier or a Marine? When did you serve in Iraq? What did you do there? Were you involved in combat? And were you also involved in Reconstruction?
Sure. I joined the Marine Corps in 1998, January of 1998, almost 2.5 years after I graduated college. I had worked in finance for some publishing companies in both Boston and New York City before I decided to join the Marine Corps. And I was in the Marine Corps, both active and reserve, for 10 years. I served in Japan, as well as had time in the Pentagon. I was on the Secretary of Navy's staff. So I got to see senior level decision making in 2002-2004. I left active duty in 2004 and joined the Department of Defense as a U.S. government civilian and went to Iraq to participate in reconstruction programs. Served a year there in Tikrit, Iraq, which is the birthplace of Saddam Hussein, and was there from May 2004 to May 2005. As, like I said, a Department of Defense civilian, I was on a State Department team that was embedded with the U.S. Army there. And so primarily did reconstruction as well as some governance-type work for that year. I came home, went to work as a consultant to the State Department and was on the State Department's Iraq desk for about 4 or 5 months before I had the opportunity to take command of a Marine Corps Reserve Combat Engineer Company. I took that opportunity and deployed with Charlie Company, 4th CEB, was the unit I was with, and we went to back to Iraq in September of 2006 and were there until end of April, beginning of May 2007 in Anbar province. And during that was primarily combat operations, operations that were part of the surge campaign of fall 2006 through spring 2007.
Wow. So you actually, your combat came very late in terms of your relationship to the Pentagon, the State Department, your Marine service, and so on.
Correct. I mean, my first deployment, while I was not directly involved in the combat, of course, the nature of the warfare there, there are IEDs, there's indirect fire, there are small arms engagements that, by necessity, you find yourselves involved in, because in a position like I was in where you're out every day working with the local Iraqi population, whether it be Iraqi government officials or Iraqi engineers or the Iraqi military or just Iraqi civilians, you find yourself out every day. So do you happen into those circumstances? So the combat end in terms of direct participation, yes, not until my second time there, but indirectly, yes. So plenty of not great things my first time in Iraq.
Yeah, well, because of the Fort Hood incident recently, people are finally paying some attention. They're alarmed about the state of returning soldiers. What was your experience when you returned from Iraq?
My first time it wasn't so bad. I had lost some Iraqis who had worked for me, some men who had been on my payroll, who had been some of my engineers who had developed quite a good relationship with, and I had lost several of them. And coming home was a very stressful year, so coming home it was difficult. It took a couple months to decompress, but there were no lingering issues, and certainly nothing I would characterize as any type of emotional distress. My second time, however, coming home, I'd had one particular incident that really affected me, and I came home and spent a few months dealing with a bout of what's classified as survivor guilt. I was in a helicopter accident. Four men died. I survived, and I, several months after the accident, was just overwhelmed by this guilt that I had not done more to save those men. And it took me several months of to get through that feeling, and it took really the loss of a relationship as well as several other things in my life to realize that, hey, I need to do something to help myself, or it's only going to get worse. But it really was. You hear about these instances where you have this period of blackness or this wave of distress just takes over you. And you read about it and you understand it, but when it happens to you, it's really overwhelming, and it can happen to anybody. I never thought it would happen to me, and it happened to me.
Right, and I'm sure that I never thought it would happen to me is echoed by so many who go over there and return.
Exactly. You receive training on this. The military is pretty good in terms of training. You understand it, particularly at the officer level. You understand what your Marines are going to go through. And I stood in front of my Marines countless times. And my first sergeant did, and my platoon commanders and platoon sergeants did, and we said to our guys, listen, if you're having problems, you need to talk to somebody. It doesn't have to be a chaplain or a psychiatrist or anyone. It could be your wife, girlfriend, your buddy, but you need to talk to somebody. But then when it happens to you, you don't follow your own advice.
I believe it. Let's move ahead so that we can deal with your resignation and the whys and so on. And so tell me, what were you doing in Zabul? What was your assignment? What were the kinds of experiences that, I think you were there 5 months at the point at which you resigned, that led to your needing to resign?
Sure. Actually, when I first arrived in Afghanistan, I was assigned to Jalalabad, which is a fairly large city, roughly in between the capital of Afghanistan, Kabul, and Peshawar, Pakistan, which is the large city in western Pakistan. And Jalalabad's roughly in between there. It's always been a center of commerce and a center of trade, and because of its position along that trunk road between those two cities. So I was assigned there. I worked with an army brigade. I was the acting political advisor to the army brigade commander there. He was responsible for military operations for the U.S. in four provinces along the Pakistan border. I spent roughly about 2 months there or so before I was moved down to Zabul province. And down in Zabul province, I was a political advisor on a United States provincial reconstruction team, which is a team of approximately 90 to 100 Americans, and we had about 40 Afghan guards who worked with us as well. And we were responsible for doing operations within the province along the lines of reconstruction, development, and governance. So it's everything to trying to get the government to actually serve the people in some capacity that we recognize back here as representative government, and then also to the engineering ends of it, of building roads, putting wells in, building schools, those kinds of things. My specific duties were to work daily with the Afghan provincial governor, who was an appointee of President Karzai. And so we were co-located with the provincial governor there. Their building was right next to our base. We had just had a simple gate that separated us, so our contact was constant. And during the 3 months or so I was there, it was daily interaction with the Afghan government, as well as getting out and visiting villages and cities within Zabul as often as possible.
Okay, and I've read that you were assigned to research the response to a question asked by Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and that experience, influenced you.
Sure, yes. That was back when I was in Jalalabad, and Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had visited, and he wanted to know why we were in one particular valley. So it wasn't assigned to me. I was just part of the group of guys who were answering this question on the brigade staff. Basically, Admiral Mullen wanted to know why we were in the Korngal Valley. And the Korngal, many of your listeners may recognize, the Korngal is in Kunar province. It's on the Pakistan border. It's been described by the New York Times as the Valley of Death. It was on the cover of Time magazine. It's probably the most recognizable site of battle in Afghanistan for the American public. The Korngal is all of 15, 20 kilometers long, maybe. It's not very big. There's only about 10,000 people who live in it. And they speak their own language. So in the year 2009, you have a valley of people who speak their own language. So right off the bat, you're thinking, why do we have troops in there? We really should have probably anthropologists in there.
Mm-hmm.
So what had happened was we found that as early as late 2004 or so, we had sent American forces in there, and they really hadn't been engaged much, very little contact with the enemy. So we were wondering why, over the course of 4 years, did it go from just really two contacts with the enemy in 8 months to the Valley of Death. What we found was that we went in there, and then this is, like we said, this is a population of 10,000 people. Their only trade is the timber trade, and they've been doing that for generations, for probably hundreds of years. And when they engage in this, when they cut the trees down and move their lumber, they don't even, for the most part, we don't even think they really even leave the mouth of their valley. We think they go to their valley, or to the mouth of the valley, and a middleman picks it up, or they go to a pass someplace. These people are only concerned about their valley and have very little interest in the world outside of it. So what happens is we go in there, we end up garrisoning it, then the Afghan National Army and Afghan National Police come in with us as well. They are not representative of the Korngalis. They're not representative of the region. They're outsiders. One of my beliefs and thesis is behind how I feel about Afghanistan is that this is a civil war. This Afghan National Army and this Afghan National Police, they're representative of the other side of the civil war, the side that the Korngalis would not be on. And so what you basically have, you have people who are fighting us to get out of the valley. And that was the conclusion we came with, was that if we left the Korngal, the site of literally dozens of American casualties, if we left the Korngal, nothing would happen. The Korngalis were not going to line up and march on Kabul next. They were just going to go about their business and be happy we weren't there.
So, in other words, this, for you, is kind of a microcosm of the whole situation?
Exactly. This is the first one I really researched and really saw clearly. Because for every, and here's, this, like I said, a microcosm, for every Korngal we're in, for all these valleys that we have, where our troops are engaged and our kids are fighting and dying, for every valley that we're in, there's like 100 that we're not. And it comes down to also an issue, too, an internal issue with Afghanistan, because what's behind this, as I started talking about the timber trade, it really comes down to the issue of taxes. Really what happens now is that you have the Afghan central government going into the Korngal Valley and going into countless other valleys and saying, yeah, that those mountains that you're cutting your trees down on, that your family's been cutting trees down on for generations, they don't belong to you. They belong to the central government, and you don't have to pay tax on that in some form. And so you think, what are we doing involved in this? Why are our troops fighting and dying over something like
right,
this?
Right, we're riding.
It has nothing to do with our security or safety as a nation.
It sounds like we're riding shotgun on a tax collector.
That's a very good way to put it. I don't want to oversimplify it, but that's a very good way to put it.
So, in other words, the work you were doing with all the best intentions led you to this conclusion that you sort of stated before, that we are enmeshed in a civil war, and I don't think that most Americans know that. What is that civil war?
A civil war that's been going on since 1973, since when the king was deposed. It's probably been going on for longer than that. But in terms of the violent aspect of it or how readily apparent it is, I mean, and then it particularly picked up in 1977-78 with the Saur Revolution, which then ultimately led to the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan. But the Civil War is basically, as I see it, it's a clash, for the most part, within Pashtun society, between the urban, the educated, the secular, the progressive, the modern, versus the rural, the poor, the religious, the traditional. And it's a very, very much a societal class within Afghanistan. one of the ways it was ascribed to me, interestingly, was from an Afghan National Army general who was very proud of the fact that his province, Badakhshan province, was one of the first provinces to start the revolution in 77 or 78, as he said. And he said the reason why they started the revolution was because the government came to our villages and asked us what our wives' names were. And so really it's an intrusion on a traditional rural life that is resented, and that is really the spark that began the Civil War that has continued throughout the 80s, throughout the 90s, and up until now. Most rural Afghans that you meet, the folks who are taking funding from the Taliban to fight us and who are fighting us because we're occupying them, or the central government's occupying them, they really see no difference in the central government, whether it was the communist government, whether it was the post-communist government under Rabini, whether it was the Taliban government or the Karzai government. They see the central government really as one and the same, as an intrusion on their lives and on their way of life.
Okay. So you came to this decision to resign and wrote a four-page letter to your superiors. I think in our conversation so far, you've stated many of the reasons that end up in that letter. But if you want to summarize, again, what were the points that lead you to such a tough decision?
Sure. Like I said, we just spoke about the Korangal and then the realization that in the east, where our troops are engaged, that's the reason for most of the combat, is that we are occupying a population. And then when I moved down to the south, I saw much of the same, and I really started to understand the Civil War aspect of it. The other part too is that this does not do anything to defeat Al Qaeda. I think most people, most folks in the intelligence community, most folks within diplomatic and military circles, agree that Al-Qaeda is an organization that is only a few thousand strong and that exists in these small networked cells that don't require any type of political or state support for their success or for their operations. That Al-Qaeda primarily exists really on the Internet, and that if we withdraw from Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda is not going to rush back into Afghanistan because they don't need to. They already have as many failed states as they want to have operations in, and they don't require a landmass to conduct their operations. So that realization, too, that, this is not doing anything to defeat Al-Qaeda, that we've got 60,000 troops here, we've got families that are sacrificing really, really good and talented young men for something that's not going to make us safer. And then also, too, just the understanding as well that Pakistan should be our priority. Pakistan, because of its nuclear weapons and because of its relationship with India and because of its prominence in the region there, that should be our priority. And our presence in Afghanistan, I think a lot of people will agree, has only destabilized Pakistan these last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So those were really the three key points that drove me to this decision. Nothing I write about in my letter is unique or novel to myself. I heard you referenced Professor Vasevich earlier. I know he has been saying some of these things for many years now, as well as within military and diplomatic circles. I've received a lot of support, and a lot of these thoughts of mine that I wrote were things that I had discussed with people before, or people had discussed with me. So nothing I say is novel or unique, and it's certainly not. There was never any eureka moment in writing this. It was basically just a compilation of 5 months.
Right, and what I hear is that it wasn't that you were the first one to come up with this. It was just that it drove you to take this personal action. How do we know that our role in Afghanistan is broken?
I think it's what we're doing there doesn't pass the common sense test. I think there's a general agreement that the people we are fighting are fighting us because we're occupying them, as well as an agreement among a lot of people that, Al-Qaeda does not exist in a form that garrisoning troops in one country is going to defeat it. So I think there's a logic test that this fails to pass. And I think that's how we know that this is not working.
Very good. And how did it get broken? In other words, that is not how did the Afghanistan situation turn into what it is, but how did our engagement there get broken? What are the causes?
I think most people agree that we lost focus on Afghanistan with the Iraq War, and I certainly don't want to get bogged down to the politics of that. Up until now, I've had tremendous bipartisan support on this issue, and I definitely would like to keep that. So,
well, I've noticed, by the way, just for listeners, I've noticed in reading other interviews you've had and so on, that you are very careful to say, you know, let's not argue about the past. Let's deal with the situation we face.
Exactly. You know, and that's really a personal, emotional thing for me, because we have kids out there. I mean, some mother probably just lost her son today, or some wife just probably lost her husband today in Afghanistan, or maybe multiple people did. So to squabble about petty partisan politics from 2004, 2005, 2006, really is a disservice to those brave young men out there. And we need to move forward. We need to analyze where we're at right now and go forward. But, you know, I think a lot of our involvement in Afghanistan, the need to be there, within domestic concerns, it comes down to a fear of another 9/11, which is a well-justified fear, because we as a nation, we cannot have an attack like that ever again. Just for the just for our economy's sake, you know, an attack like that right now would be terrible for us. And so Al Qaeda needs to be our primary threat. How we lost focus on that, I'm not sure how we got into this point where we're just continuing to march lockstep forward, doing the same thing over and over again in Afghanistan, one year after next. Well, hey, it hasn't been working, so let's just double our forces and be able to work again. I'm not sure why we have that think, why there's that group think, why there's that mentality, but it exists and it needs to change. And we need to recognize that the threat's Al-Qaeda, the priority should be Pakistan, and that having these troops, our troops there, 60,000 troops or maybe up to 100,000 troops, will not defeat Al-Qaeda and will not stabilize Pakistan.
Okay. Finally, the how do we fix it? What are the solutions? And I have a feeling I'm asking you two questions in that. One is basically what you were just alluding to, is that what do you think is the would be best for the U.S. in Afghanistan? The second might be what should listeners do if they agree with that?
Sure. Okay. Thanks. My recommendation is this: stop fighting the people who are fighting us only because we're occupying them, or because the central government is occupying them. Recognize that it's a civil war, and that civil wars only end through political reconciliation. They can also end by one side decimating the other, or just both sides tiring of the fighting and segregating themselves from one another. Neither one of those are good courses of action for us or for the world community or for the people of Afghanistan. So we need to recognize that it's a civil war, and we need to really, really push hard for political reconciliation. I don't believe the Karzai administration has any interest whatsoever in reconciliation. They've not done any of it in the last 8 years, and I don't believe they will do any reconciliation attempts in the next several years. Like I said, stop combat operations in those valleys and villages where people are fighting us, where our presence only fuels the insurgency, where it only legitimizes our enemy's claims as well as the claims and justifies Al-Qaeda's existence. We need to look at re-engaging, or not re-engaging, but doubling our efforts with Pakistan. And I'm not a Pakistan expert, so I don't know if that means go really hard on Pakistan or go real easy, you know, give them everything they need with no strings attached, or lean real heavily on them. I'm not sure which way to go on that, but that needs to be our focus.
That should be the conversation that we're having 6 months from now, or a year from now, rather than this one. But let me ask, when you say reconciliation, that's reconciliation between whom?
Between the various factions within Afghanistan. And you got to be very careful, because we don't want Afghanistan to return to a state of warlordism, but we also can't have a country where the vast majority of the rural population is distanced or not included in the government. So you're going to have to bring in members of the Taliban into the government. And that in order to get true reconciliation, in order to get an Afghanistan that is not a failed state, you are going to need to have members of the Taliban in the Afghanistan government.
Okay, so that sounds like an enormous challenge. And that second part of that question, which I ask, is what should listeners do? We've gotten to the point where we've got to end this interview, but I would just say basically learn as much as you can. Look at rethinkafghanistan.com for a lot of information. Google Matthew Ho, and you can see other things he has said. And then just make sure that you are keeping your representatives informed of your feelings. I've been speaking with Matthew Ho. He's the former Marine Iraq War vet. He recently resigned his role with the Foreign Service in Afghanistan because he couldn't participate in the continued occupation. I recommend you look him up, as I said, on Google. Read that letter of resignation. Thank you, Matthew Ho, and continue to keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence.